Welcome to the Dental Implant Podcast with your host, Pav Kara, your source of knowledge for all things relating to dental implants. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you learned something valuable. I hope.
Welcome back to the next episode of the Dental Implant Podcast. And I am very happy and excited to have one of my technicians join me today. Ashley is from Burns Dental Lab and I've been using Ash for about a year and a half now. Phenomenal work as always, Ash. Thank you very much. And I've known Ashley for a long time. And in fact, I knew his dad beforehand because I got introduced to Burns Dental Lab when it was Tony who was running it.
Yeah,
and the reason why I got introduced to it is because Tony was Mike Wise's technician back in the day, I believe.
That was actually me.
But
it was my dad that was running the lab.
Well, I did Mike's course back in 2004-ish, 5-ish, yeah, something like that. Absolutely phenomenal. And Mike opened my eyes to the importance of not only technical excellence from a dentist point of view, but also the importance from a lab point of view. And I'm not here to dictate to anybody how they should be operating because we're all in different practices. We've all got different demographics. I'm fortunate that I am now in a position where I've built up over very, very many years that I can afford to charge patients more. And because I'm charging patients more, I'm very picky with my lab work as well. So the reason why I've asked Ashley to come on today is Ashley will do his own little intro in just a moment. The reason why I've asked him to come on is because there will be a whole host of things that your technician wished you knew or wished you were doing or wished you wouldn't do. And Ashley's going to give you the insights from his perspective, what makes his life easy, what makes his life hard. He'll give us a little bit of an update on some of the newer materials, newer techniques, and just give us a little bit of an insight. So, Ash, we can go for as long as what we want today. I feel like this is going to be quite a healthy-sized podcast, and I'm going to jump in with questions as and when I feel that they're coming up. So if I could ask you just to do an introduction to yourself, and then at that point, let's start with things that you get sent that you were just like, oh, you know what? I wish the dentist hadn't done this. And obviously, we're focusing on implants, mate. So yeah. I don't care about anything else. We're going to stick to implants.
Yeah, I mean, introduction to myself. My name is Ashley Byrne. I run Byrne's Dental Laboratory. We're a team of, we're a fairly big lab. We're 50 people doing sort of high-end implant work, crown and bridge dentures and everything that goes in between to be able to do that, you know. And we're running a really good team, very cutting edge, very forward thinking. And it's a nice lab and it's a nice team of people. But yeah, in reference to sort of the question really, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, my biggest challenge probably is lack of information. So it's not a case of what I don't want them to send or whatnot's right. It's actually just no information. And I would say that, 70 to 80% of all full arches that arrive in my lab, I don't know how I'm restoring them. I've had no input into the planning. And that's not a major problem for me, but we need to know what is the final restoration outcome? You know, what is the patient's expectations? And I think the biggest challenge that we face probably is not knowing the patient, not having that information. You know, some patients want just function. Some patients want a beautiful smile. And just having a little bit more of a knowledge base of what the patient's expectations is would be vital to me. You know, we have a few customers that send us little videos, little WhatsApp videos of what the patient is expecting from the treatment. And that to us, that little 30-second video for us is priceless. So it's, you know, I get weird and wonderful stuff. You know, we get a lot of strange implant work. We're seeing a huge rise in random implant systems that have been restored in Turkey and Thailand, and that's an enormous headache for us, but we're always trying to help people. And from our perspective, I think it's a case of we're trying to simplify implant dentistry into protocols. Nice simple stages, you know, do A, B, C, D, and you'll always get B. But I think we do get a lot of, I would say maybe slightly younger dentists that have seen something on Instagram, and that's always my worst scenario. There's some great stuff on Instagram, but there's some terrible stuff on Instagram. And we do see some random processes. And I think some of my frustration is that we see weird stuff coming into the laboratory where we haven't been consulted. So different ways of scanning. You know, I saw this new technique of using this thing to scan, so I scanned it. Talk to your lab first, you know, find out what the scan bodies are, find out the best way of scanning. You know, we deal with, you know, we probably receive probably around 50 scans a day of implant work. And there's not much I don't think I haven't seen, but I'm amazed that the first time sometimes somebody tries a new concept, you know, it just arrives to us. So my advice always would be talk to your technician, you know, before you go ahead and do that thing with the IOS, just talk to us, what are your impressions?
I think the other thing as well on that is a couple of things I'm going to say is, firstly, quite often you think, oh, wow, that's a clever idea. But you've seen something 1,000 times that works. Yeah. And you're like, actually, you know, instead of this, use this instead, because we've already got the workflow. We know how it works. It's predictable. I've done it with somebody. They've done it 300 times and we know it's predictable. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we're very quick to look at Instagram cases. And what we need to remember on Instagram is I don't see very many people posting failures. Everybody's just posting their successes, and we all have failures, right? And Ash, I'm sure that this is a point from your perspective as well, is occasionally, from a technical point of view, you will have a failure for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the nature of the work.
It's impossible not to.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned as well with regards to photos and videos going over to you for full arch, this is a tip that I'll give to everybody listening now. There's three records which are really important for me in terms of photography, and it's not a full sequence of smile photographs, okay? That's nice, but the three critical ones that you need, okay? Number one is a lip at rest photo, okay? Mm-hmm. That is the patient just breathing through their mouth. Yeah. If you can't see the incisal edge, what you need to know is you need to put a perio probe on the incisal edge of the tooth and then measure how far beyond the incisal edge that the wear has actually gone. Because if you're supposed to show 2 millimeters of incisal edge at rest and you can't see the incisal edge of the tooth at rest, then you need to know how much you actually need to build that up. Otherwise, it's just guesswork, okay? Yeah. The other thing that you need is a full smile photograph, and I mean a really, really, really wide smile photograph, okay? I know a lot of people at this time point, they'll start to take occlusal photos, lateral photos, and things like that, and all that's great, okay? But here's another amazing tip that I can give to you is if you take a video of the patient, and as the patient is doing this, you are moving from a front position to a lateral position and back and forwards, left and right hand sides. You want the patient to be counting from 50 all the way up to 70, 50, 51, 52, mm-hmm. all the way up to 70. Because what that will do is, firstly, on the video, your technician can pause it to see the lateral aspect, okay? Yep. But it will also show the technician how that they are producing the F and V sounds.
Yeah.
Ash, I mean, that's just something that I do, but is that something that's useful for you?
Yeah, video like that? Yeah, very much so. And I think it's, you know, it is, we get a lot of random photographs in the lab. You know, one of the things that tends to also drive me nuts is a lot of people do retracted photographs first. So they do all the retracted photographs and then they take the retractors out and then they take the at rest photos, but they're never at rest because the retractors have naturally pulled all the lip up. So the lip line always is naturally higher. We tend to recommend that, you know, I mean, one of our advice is when you're taking your patient's photographs, start as far away from the patient as you can. So you want your full face, you know, then you get closer to the eyes and then you get close to the mouth and then you get much closer. Then you can do your retracted, then you can do your individual tooth photos. Start away from the patients and move in. And I still every week get you can see it, you know, you can just see the retraction cheap lines, you know, and it doesn't give us the right information. And I think your advice there of using the periodontal probe when they're naturally at rest is priceless to us, because we do need that information. And, you know, one of the, we're using a lot more 2D imaging now in our smile design cases. So when we're doing a full arch or a denture, with modern software now, if the teeth are in the image, we can actually link that to the iOS scan or the scan of the impression. So then it gives us the eyes, it gives us the nose, it gives us the face. So when we've got, you know, multiple smile photos and we've got these videos, it does allow us to really see where the smile actually is compared to 95% of cases in my lab where I just get the lips. And then that's no reference to where the eyes are, the nose are. It is quite challenging for us.
So if you were to get a good sequence of photographs where, you know, as you said, the photographs are starting at a distance and then slowly coming in, and you've got the video and, you know, you've got the lip at rest photos, how much easier does that make your life?
Oh, it just, I mean, massively, hugely. You know, I would say the number one challenge in my laboratory today is lack of information. And that goes across everything from, you know, there's one thing having a single photograph, but having full face, lips at rest, biggest smile possible, small video, retraction. It also goes with like the iOS scans. Even a single posterior crown, I still get an awful lot of half arch scans, which is quite challenging for us because one, we can't verify the bite's correct. But secondly, dentistry, you're always trying to look at inspiration for what's in the mouth. So if I'm doing a single posterior molar, my first bit of inspiration is, let's look at the other side, and then it's not there. So then you're guessing the anatomy, you're guessing the shape. So information across all aspects. Don't, you know, that extra scan would have taken 20, 30 seconds. And we always try and encourage people to just take a little bit more time, add another 2 to 3 minutes, take a few more photographs. I would never say to anybody, I never have enough photographs or never have enough data. So more the merrier for me.
Okay. I was smiling as you were saying that because one of my questions were, do you receive a lot of like sextant scans or quadrant scans where you really could be doing with
it? I mean, it's when you've got a patient that's got a horrendous gag reflex and you want to get this done as quick as you possibly can, we completely understand that. And that's just the nature of dentistry. But, you know, when we're doing a lot of single posteriors, it is really, really helpful. And particularly for us as a challenge, when we've got, say, post-ortho cases where the occlusion might not be as obvious as possible. You know, I can have an anterior open bite and I've got a quadrant. So that immediately red flags to us that the bite's wrong. But actually, it might be right. But because I haven't got the full arch, I can't print the models and hand mount them to double check it. There's no way of referencing it. So I would say if people can avoid quadrants at all costs, that would be great.
So you really need the full arches.
Yeah, ideally. It doesn't have to be perfect, but a full arch scan would be really good for us.
So there's a couple of things that I want to touch on now, Ash, off the back of what you're saying. And you know what? They're just escaping my mind. It sounds weird. Okay, I remember now. So from a lab perspective, do you have intraoral scanners which are favorite in terms of interface, in terms of ease of workflow? Do you find some scanners give you better outcomes?
Yep.
Because obviously, as dentists, we hear it from the dental point of view, but what about the technical point, the technician's point of view? What's your favorite? Are there any that you'd say this causes a major headache for XYZ reason?
Yeah, I mean, without that, I mean, for me, probably the most reliable scanner is probably Trios from 3Shape. That's the most reliable. We get great results from iTero, Medit. Sometimes iTero struggles a little bit with soft tissue, but there's little workarounds. You tend to find that there is a correlation that the more you spend on a scanner, in our experience, generally, the better the result you're going to find. There is a lot of cheaper models on the market. And if you're doing single posterior crowns all the time, those scanners are fine. But as soon as you start to get into implants, it becomes much, much more challenging. And we do need accuracy and we need data. You also need to be very, very careful, I think, with some of the data on scanners. Because I've got, if I put 10 papers in front of me, I can show you a paper that shows that the iTero is the most accurate, that the prime scan is the most accurate, the iTero is the most accurate. And actually, some of those papers may be categorically correct. One thing that I don't think people are discussing is ease of use, because you can have the most, you know, if I take my BMW and I want to get somewhere, you know, around a racetrack as fast as I can, I will take my BMW and actually I'll probably get a pretty good time. You give me a Formula One car, I probably will stall it. I'll probably crash it. It might be the fact is that's the fastest car, but I don't know how to use it. And I think we don't talk about this enough with scanners. A lot of the scans in my lab are done by nurses and by practice managers, and ease of use is vital. And we get so hung up on accuracy in dentistry, we don't necessarily think about ease of use. And you might have a scanner that maybe is, say, 2% less accurate than another scanner, but it's 25% easier to use. Over the period of a commercial practice where we have time pressures, patient pressures, all the rest of it that goes with it, you're going to get vastly better results with that. And that's probably why we get the best results with the Trios, because it's so easy to use. I mean, I can teach someone to use a Trios in minutes. Itera is also very easy to use. You know, the Medit's very easy to use. You know, and it, I think that's where we see these benefits from these scanners.
Yeah. I think from my point of view, because I have the Medit, I have the wireless i700.
Yep,
great scanner. I think one of the factors that I like on it is there's a button that you can press, which turns the scan green as you're scanning it.
Yeah.
And then what actually ends up happening is it's light green to start with, and then it builds up to a very dark green.
Yeah, nice.
When it's that very dark green, that means that the scan data is very accurate.
Yep.
Exactly. Actually, as I'm going around, I'm looking for any light green areas because that tells me that I've missed a bit in my scanner.
Yeah. I mean, we would always say never scan in color.
Yeah.
You know, it looks pretty, it looks beautiful, but it's absolutely useless.
It does look really nice, doesn't it?
I mean, it's just terrible for us. I mean, we don't ever design in color. We always design in gray because it picks up all the surface texture, the details. We will only use color, for example, when we're looking for, say, margins and we can't quite see the margin, then color becomes useful. But actually, even then, the vast majority of the time, we'll go back. And this, again, this goes back to it, that you might see papers that show that the Medit is maybe not the most accurate. But using that green data, you know, and showing that, you're very likely to get those results. And that's why, you know, from our perspective, we do get such good results with the Medit.
Well, that's really interesting. Mm. Yeah, because obviously, you know, when I was looking into getting a scanner, it was always like, well, this is the most accurate, this is the most accurate, this is the most accurate. And one of the reasons why I got the Medit is because the interface was so simple to use.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I like about it is there's no monthly fee on it.
No, that's always good.
I think everything's becoming subscription nowadays, and it gets to the point where it gets ridiculously expensive. So I was you know what? I'm only using it for implants. I don't need it to do anything flashy. That's the reason why I went down that route.
No, exactly that. I think also it's worth, you know, with a scanner, one of these things I also say is be careful of what I call scanner clubs. You chat to your friends, I've got an Itera. You've got to get an Itera. And, you know, and then, okay, he's got an Itera, must be good. So then you want everyone to have the same as you, so you feel you're part of this sort of club. My advice always is to you've got to really clear your mind of that and get a demo, you know, and get your nurses involved. Don't make the decision yourself. And, you know, each have a scan, have a go, you know, try on each other, and then send that scan to your lab. And your lab also is very good at assessing the quality of the scan that came back, because I have people that can use Medit beautifully. I have people that use Medit more or less so. Same with Trios, same with Itera, same with all the platforms. It's a bit like impression material. You know, some people smash in program out of the park. Other people, looks like the dog's eaten it. And yet they can use another silicone and they nail it. And again, play to what you and your team like. And I think you'll get the best results out of your scanner. And do also talk to your lab as well. Don't ever buy a scanner without talking to your lab.
Yeah. So Ash, correct me if I'm wrong, but you now rarely do work with physical impressions. You're pretty much digital now, is that correct?
Yeah. The funny thing is, I looked at this yesterday. We're 84% iOS to 26% conventional impressions.
So is there a particular reasoning for your transition, or are you finding, you know, what hiccups have you found along the way, you know, and how are you resolving these basically?
Yeah, I mean, multiple reasons. First and foremost, now that being the lab that we are, you know, I'd like to, without sort of sounding egotistical or whatever, we're a very cutting edge lab using some really cool cutting edge technologies. And there's an interesting, you know, challenge in dentistry at the moment, that the average age of a technician now is nearly 60 in the UK. That's the same across Europe, same across the States. And in the next 5 years, you're going to see 50% of all dental technicians retire. And I run a beautiful lab. It's in a beautiful setting, and we encourage some really good people to work with us. But it's becoming more and more challenging. I've had an advert for a plaster technician out now for nearly 2 years. I've had one CV. I've had one job interview, and that particular technician ghosted me, never arrived. So that's a challenge for me at the moment, because nobody wants to do model room. Nobody wants to work with plaster any longer. It's messy, it's dirty. That's not a modern lab anymore. We're working with cool prints, CAD-CAM technology. Who wants to be messing around with gypsum? We also find that with the modern workflows now of, say, 3D printed dentures and zirconia and really beautifully milled frameworks, iOS is really, it's you know, noughts and ones. It's very, very black and white for me. And I don't have to worry too much about accuracy these days. There's ways of verifying and checking. And I really like the iOS workflow. Like, one of the things with implant work, if you want to skip a verification stage, what you can do is do your scan of your implants, do your opposing, do your bite registration, send the case. Then do another scan of the implants and the scan body. Do two separately. We will overlay those two scans. If those two scans are perfect, we know we have a very accurate scan. If they're not, then we will verify. But digital workflow for me, you know, nothing gets lost in the post. If it does, it's digital. I can remanufacture it. The worst case scenario, I'm going to move the appointment. And for me, everything that we're doing with the lab, with milling, you know, with our ExoCAD and 3Shape software, the iOS workflow for me just works much better. And now, for the first time ever, I'm seeing my iOS accuracies, remakes, and adjustments significantly lower than conventional impressions now. And my target, realistically, is to probably close my model room by end of this year. We will still have a model section, because sometimes you just need to take a full arch with a Imprigum, or there's various reasons your scanner might go down. We'll still have that, but I don't particularly want to be working with analog custers anymore now, because I can do better with iOS, and that's where I sit with it personally for me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when it comes to scanning full arches, you said to take two sets of separate scans and you'll overlay them. So, you know, on the podcast I've had before, we're talking about the OptiSplint. You've got Nexus iOS with their extra long scan flags, albeit that's locked directly to their lab for obvious reasons, for just from a business point of view. You have other things like scan ladders and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. I've also seen people put scan flags in it and then use a little bit of like flowable composites to really simple, a little bit draw squiggly rind so that the scanner will track over that little bit of squiggly composite between the soft tissue.
Don't overcomplicate it.
What do you like? What do you not like?
I don't like, you know, there's various forms of things like scan ladders and stuff on the market. They work okay. They create a lot of scan scatter. There's a lot of work for the lab to remove. I personally, for me, it's a case of the way you've got to think about, if you think about an iOS scanner, like let's say you've got a jigsaw puzzle of the beach. That's the best way I like to my analogy. Where you've got all of your people on the beach with the different colored umbrellas and bikinis and all the rest of it, that part of the jigsaw puzzle is really easy. Okay, when you've got the sky and it's all blue and there's very, very little change in color, that part of the jigsaw puzzle is a nightmare. That's exactly how an iOS works. It's putting these pictures over each other and it's looking for things that are, you know, that they can link together. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. If you've got a big area of gum that's very smooth and there's no rugae and there's no nothing on there, the scanner can't do that. And that's where you get your levels of inaccuracy, that it can't work out how to stitch them together. So if you put a little squiggle of composite on there or some little composite blobs, it will. But don't put three of the same size blob on, because then it gets very confused. It's also the things like the scan bodies, that if you've got, you know, when you're scanning an art full arch of, say, four implants or six implants, whatever, you don't need six scan bodies. You can use two and you can sort of go over each other. One of the problems we have with scan bodies is they're identical. So the scanner can actually very quickly get confused and can actually sort of try and stitch between the two. That's also a challenge. I mean, I'm not too fussed about that one. And that's where things like, say, Nexus is so good that you know, there's no two scan bodies are the same. That's how it works. But for me, you know, we receive a full-out scan every single day now with iOS. I would say the vast majority of them are just with a good quality scan body. Again, talk to your lab what scan bodies they like. I very rarely see little composite blobs on there, but I do occasionally. I like composite blobs of different sizes and shapes. You can do a little cross, you can do a little circle. You can paint noughts and crosses in the patient's mouth, and as long as they're all different, because they're so easy to remove. You know, when you've got things that are, you know, I've got people sticking things in the mouth and sliding them over scan bodies. They're very difficult for us to remove. And the problem also is that with a scan body, you need as much of that scan body as possible in the scan, because that's what we're relating over to the software. It's looking for a perfect match. If it's covered in something, we start to lose the accuracy of that. So little blobs of composite, different sizes, that works a treat for me. But yeah, take your time with it. Don't rush it. You know, check your scan afterwards. You know, you're looking for round scan bodies. You don't want to see them oblong shape. And it's the top kind of 2/3 of the scan body is the most important part. But I think, yeah, take your time and also follow the protocols. Every scanner scans differently. Some are better going across the arch. Some are better round. Look on YouTube, see what people are doing. You know, listen to your training very carefully, and you'll get the best results from your scanner depending on how the technology of that scanner works.
That's really cool. What somebody needs to invent is like just a sticky plaster that you can literally put over the soft tissue that's got a pattern on it.
Wouldn't be a bad way of doing it. Yeah, we need some way. I think we overcomplicate it sometimes, in my opinion.
Okay. So. Scan bodies.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, when you get a particular implant system, the implant companies will turn around and say, yes, you know what? You need to use our scan body because it's the most accurate, this, that, and the other. Is that always the case? Are you finding some scan bodies are better than others? Do you have any particular implant systems where it's just like, oh, you know what? I wish they'd just completely redesign their scan body.
Yeah.
So basically, what's the correlation between the scan body that we're using intraorally and how easy it is for you in the lab and the accuracy? Because to be fair, mate, at the end of the day, I don't care whether it's particularly easy for you as long as I get a good result. Exactly. Being easy for you is just a bonus.
Yeah. Well, that's it. But I get that as well. There is. I mean, there's some companies that do really irritating things. I'll give you an example, and I don't mean to bring, but I've complained about this multiple times. MegaGen make two scan bodies, a short and a long, right? And the top parts are identical. So when they're under the soft tissue and you're running late and you put your scan bodies in, and it arrives to the lab and I go, did you use short or long? And then I hear the silence.
We've had this conversation before as well.
It's like, oh, no, I don't know. Well, I'll ask the nurse. She's got no recollection. Why they make two? If you're going to make a short one and a long one, make the top different. So we can very clearly in the lab see whether the short or the long is used. Some companies use engaging and non-engaging scan borders, which, again, I don't really understand why they're using that. Because you can very easily grab a non-engaging scan body, not realize it, screw it down, and then we make a single crown and the hex is out. I don't understand why companies are making non-engaging scan bodies. We don't need them. They're absolutely pointless. One of the things with using non-engaging impression copings years ago was that when you had two very diverging implants, you couldn't pull them out the impression. We're not doing that with scan bodies. So why are we using non-engaging? On a multi-unit, I get, but when you're doing fixture level, it doesn't make any sense. Also, be very careful of commercial entities. You know, dentistry's got a lot of money in it. And some of the companies now are being a bit cheeky and they're releasing new scan bodies very quickly to market and they are attached to their milling company. So what we have to do is then we get the scan body, we have to use their replica, which I haven't got a problem with. But then when you're attached, you have to use their milling center. That's a problem for me because I like to use what I feel to be best, the most accurate on the market. And I don't like to be forced to be using a product because the manufacturer wants me to use it because of sales. If it's a great product, great, but sometimes it's not. And again, this is why I really recommend people talk to their labs, because if a certain scan body comes in and then I'm attached to using that particular milling center, and let's say, for example, that you know we were going to do a particular type of bar, and actually that milling company doesn't make that bar, now I need another scan and another impression, which is an enormous inconvenience for everybody. And also try to use the same brand of scan body. there are workarounds, but I mean, I've got a scan in literally 2 weeks ago, and we had five different brands in five different implants. It's workable, but it's painful for us. And that's, you know, one of the challenges that people don't understand with that, it's not actually the software. I can very easily produce five different, you know, sort of scan bodies, rest of it. But then it becomes challenges with each scan body to replica has a different printing parameter. So then that starts to mess with the printing parameters. And then also it restricts your milling companies that you can send these to. And people don't often think about the where the lab's challenges are, because this is all in a cloud workflow.
And if so it's connected,
it doesn't work.
I just want to clarify. So if you've got, let's say you've got five different brands of implant in the mouth, they're not, as long as the brand of the scan flag is the same, even though it's a different implant, that makes it easy for you. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like one of my preferences is ELOS. ELOS works really well for me. They make for nearly every single platform on the market. IPD is a really good scan body as well. Again, they make for multiple platforms on the market. It's when we've got one Atlantis Flow, we've got one Straumann, we've got one ELOS, we've got one Medentika, and we've got another one. That's when it becomes challenging for me. But if you can find the brand of the scan body across multiple platforms, it does make our life a little bit easier for sure.
Okay. And then going back to what you were saying a little bit about when you're doing multiples and the scan bodies are the same, it ends up being tricky for the iOS.
Yeah, sometimes. not often, but it can be.
Is there any scope to doing a slight modification to all of these? Not to the point where it'll interfere with the scan body, but just so that they're slightly different. Like if I sent scan bodies out to you and you put just like disc marks into them, so in one you put one and next one you put two, does that help or is that?
I wouldn't overcomplicate it. What I'm trying to get across when using scan bodies is that focus on scanning one scan body first, and then go back onto the soft tissue, and then onto the next scan body, and then back onto the soft tissue, and onto the next scan body. Okay. If you have got two scan bodies side by side, and you're scanning them, and actually the scanner is only picking up the scan bodies, it's picking up two bits of identical data. So you want to come from the soft tissue up the scan body, and try not to scan two scan bodies at the same time. Sometimes you can't. They're just, you know, 2 mil apart. But if you can come from the soft tissue, the scanner then starts to recognize they're different. That's what I was referring to, really. Yeah.
Got you. Makes sense. So let's move on to original componentry versus third-party componentry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the data that I've seen is when you're buying the original components from the manufacturer, because they know exactly what the tolerances are, everything's much more precise. And this can have a knock-on effect long-term. Now, that said, I know a lot of the newer milling strategies and products that are coming out from third-party companies, they're becoming significantly more and more accurate. The name that keeps coming up for me at the moment, and I know this is a company that we've discussed before as well, Ash, is New Ancorvis.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on original componentry versus third-party componentry? What do you think of New Ancorvis? And are there pros and cons, or is it, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely pros and cons. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, I've got, you know, BMW M5. It's a nice car. It's a high-performance car. I want BMW genuine parts fitted to that. And I would genuinely believe that the vast majority of those components are better. Okay, so I'm a big genuine on genuine fan. However, in dentistry, it is slightly different. Now, I think you should be using genuine screws if you can. I think they're good. Again, we've seen screw technology improve vastly. The problem I have is not necessarily with, say, milling companies. If I'm using, say, a Dentsply Sirona implant, I try to make sure it goes to Atlantis. If I'm using a Straumann implant, I try to make sure it goes to Creatench. But it's more that tie bases are a big part of what we do. Tie bases bring the cost of implant dentistry down, and they're great. But a lot of tie bases are really badly designed. You're looting a zirconia crown to a tie base. Now, if you've got a molar and it's in an implant in an ideal position and there's been no perio and it's all fine, it works. The challenges we sometimes face, though, is a lot of companies, the tie bases are too short. So we end up with a slightly deep implant. We don't have much gingival height changes. So some implant companies do one gingival height, some do five. So we've got really deep implants, which is angulated, and we're trying to keep the cost down. Then, for example, I might switch to something like, say, a new Encorvus. The advantage of the new Encorvus for me is that we have a much taller chimney. And, you know, in those cases where I've got those crowns, I will use a new Encorvus. I'm very happy with the quality of them. I also use companies like IPD. But there's a lot of there's a lot of secondary componentry that I won't use. Because we're seeing irregularities in milling. We're seeing some of the challenges of the fit. I don't like the fact I can't use genuine screws sometimes. I want to be able to have versatility. And again, we've got to be very careful when we talk about copycat companies that we understand that there are really, really high quality ones and there are really, really poor quality ones. And, you know, there's an argument that, you know, Straumann have always said to me many years ago, don't use Medentika. And then Straumann buys Medentika,
Medentika
becomes genuine. It's the same product. And that irritates me a little bit with the marketing side of things. You know, Createch was never a Straumann company, but it is now. So it wasn't genuine, and now it is genuine, and there's no changing in the parameters. And that's marketing to a certain extent.
I have a saying, Ash, is you need to understand the evidence to such a deep level that yes. You can call companies out on their marketing bullshit. It yeah. sounds like it's the same on the technical side of things as
it
well.
It is very much so, yeah. I mean, look, Createch to me is one of the best milling companies in the world, you know, and Straumann were very, very clever to have bought that company and they've taken Createch to new levels. And so I'm not saying it's necessarily right or wrong, but it's a case of just being knowledgeable and worldly of it. But talk to your lab, and there's one thing between a cost saving and an improvement in treatments, and the two are very different. And there are many, many cases that I do in my lab where I use a non-genuine component, and I stand by the fact it's a better restoration for the patient. We're going to get less fractures and failures. And again, that's where you need to lean on your lab with knowledge base. But I can get a tie base for £20. I can pay £120. And the two are chalk and cheese. And we've got to be careful that we don't blur the lines between profit and ethical dentistry.
I think one of the things for me as well, particularly when it comes to my lab work, and the reason why I've ended up with yourself as well, Ash, is I just want my crowns to drop into place.
Yeah.
I'm extremely lazy when it comes to clinical work. You know, this is why my workflows are all based around accelerating treatment, because I want the patients to be done because they want to be done as well.
Yeah, very much so.
I'm now doing certain cases where it's placement of implant and definitive restoration at the same visit, because you can do that with guided now. Okay, and you know. When I was younger, less experienced, not charging as much, you'd find cheaper labs, and then the contacts would always be tight. The occlusion was always wrong. So what is it that you see very frequently that has a knock-on effect on this? Because I've had you on the Academy as well speaking about this, and the few things that we spoke about is particularly when you've got an implant going into place, just flattening the contacts of the teeth before you take the scan can work absolute wonders. Yep. And obviously making sure that the implant's in a good position. A number of cases that I see, implants are just in a poor position, or it's completely the wrong diameter, placed too shallow. You can't get the correct emergence contours. What's the common frequency? What's the common things that you see that you think to yourself, you know what? If only they'd have done this, it had made it way more easier for me. The occlusion would have been better. The contacts would have been.
I mean, it's a big question. We see all sorts of problems. I mean, contact points is a challenging for me. You know, that especially when you've got, say, like, you know, you've had a patient that's lost that tooth for 10 years. Now they want an implant. You're going to have those teeth are going to have tilted in. You know, that there's going to be some movement. Whenever teeth do tilt inwards a little bit, it can create food traps, it can create complications. And I feel sometimes that we bang the implant in and then it's like, right, lab to restore it. And then it arrives and we're like, ugh, you know, we've got huge.
Ow.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, oh, if the contact points have just been tweaked or adjusted, we get an enormous amount of IOS scans with no contact points. The scanners come round over the top of the teeth and then the contact points are missing, or they might just be slightly patchy and then they're not accurate. That's a challenge for us as well. we get an awful lot of impressions and scans coming in. I mean, scans more commonly, I say, where the patient is not quite closed. You ask the patient to close, and as the scanner comes in, they're just fractionally open. And again, that's a challenge for us now. Now, we're using AI now to fix that, and that's working very well, but it's an additional cost. But I would say probably the biggest challenges I face probably is just fractionally out of occlusion. That's a challenge for me. I think it's more just not thinking. Full arches are actually relatively easy for us these days, but it's the single premolars and the molars where there's been a little bit of tooth movement is probably one of my biggest challenges. And just think, you know, correctly about it. Just think methodically about it. You know, look at it and see. And if you could adjust those and tweak those contacts just a tiny, tiny little bit, what does make our life a lot easier, which in turn means that we can make a crown that drops in, no occlusal adjustment, no contact adjustment, everyone's happy.
Perfect. So the next thing I wanted to ask, you know, I've got a bad habit of doing this. I've got so many questions in my head, I tend to forget them. So it'll come back to me in a second. I'll circle back to this. Let me ask a different question while we're on this, okay? Oh, no, I remember. Why does it always happen? I've remembered what this is now, okay? A lot of the issues that I see with a lot of implants is they are placed too shallow.
Yeah.
And people are using the wrong diameter, placed too shallow, and that has a knock-on effect.
Yeah, it does.
But how many cases are you seeing where it's just like the, let's say that the implant positioning's not bad.
Yeah.
But let's say, had it been done guided, that it would have been significantly better.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I don't tend to suffer too much from shallow implants, if I'm honest with you. That's not a major problem for me. It does happen. And we can get around shallow implants with things like, we can use the conial abutments, which I'm not a huge fan of because they do fracture. But there are little tweaks and ways that we can get around it. I get more badly placed implants, usually buccally, palatally, buccally, lingually, which even a pilot guide wouldn't have made a huge difference for. We're an implant lab. That's what we predominantly do. And yet, I would say we make probably 3 guides a week, and yeah, I'm restoring 30 implants a day, 40 implants a day.
Wow.
I'm saying that the vast majority are fine, but there are cases where I think, I know it's additional cost, but I do feel pilot guided or guided would have solved the situations, particularly when you've got minimal space and you've got challenges. You know, there's nothing worse for me than having a lower anterior and I find the implant is just off, because then I've got a wonky emergence and the patient's going, well, the teeth looks wonky. Started in the wrong position. That's a real challenge for us. And then the problem also with implants, particularly in tight spaces, is that, especially if we're using like custom abutments or tie bases, the problem I've got is that you've got a metal substructure in there and then you're wrapping zirconia around it. So we then end up with a very, very, very thin wall of zirconia on one side, and that massively increases the fracture. And nearly always, if I do get a fracture, it's nearly always at the neck. And it's normally an implant where the implant has not been in the center. So moving that implant to the center by using a guide or pilot guided, would have solved that fracture categorically. And it's a small thing that I think gives a patient a much better long-term result, personally for me.
So, this is one of the things that Nick Fahey and myself discussed on one of the previous podcasts. And I've done a lot of freehand placements,
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with
that. Most of them are pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, a decent number of, you know, wow, you wouldn't be able to tell that was freehand. It looks like I did it guided.
Yeah.
But it's that 5-6% of cases where it's just like, what the hell happened here?
Yeah.
And then it's just, you know, I'm at that point in my career. And I do believe careers are a progression, right? This happens over time. But I think what people need to do is they need to push to this sooner rather than later. But again, it's a double-edged sword, mate. You know, if you're relying fully on guided, you don't build up the analog skills.
Yeah, correct.
You need both. But you need to get to the point where, you know, every case, even if you think it's a slam dunk, you know, ideally we want to get to the point where it's all fully guided.
Yeah.
Because then what happens, everything's in the right place.
I mean, I think, you know, we were having this conversation actually. I do a lot with the Dental Laboratory Association. I'm involved in GDC stakeholders and all that kind of thing. And it is interesting that one of the things that, and I'm also part of a European group, and we all discuss the challenges. And one of the things that keeps seeming to circulate, particularly in Europe, is that there's a pressure coming from government bodies now in reference to ethical dentistry, that all cases should be guided. If you have an implant in the wrong place and you haven't used a guide, then you're potentially liable. And I wonder whether we're going to see this start rearing its sort of, well, I say ugly head. I'm not sure it is an ugly head. I think it probably is the solution. But I think we might need to see more and more go guided, particularly on challenging cases, because it does create a lot of problems when the implant's in the wrong place. And either you're explanting it or we're compromising the restoration, which would have been sold for a £100 guide. So it's an interesting area of debate.
Yeah, I've heard of some people, some labs turn around and say, you know what, if you go fully guided, we'll give you X amount discount on your crown, because they know that the crown work's then going to just be way easier by comparison.
Yeah, I think it would be. I mean, I think it's what I've never even thought about that business model, actually. It's something I might actually consider, because to me, certainly, it does make our life vastly easier. It also, you know, that if you're trying to watch your costs on your patients and you use guided, you'll be able to use a tie base. Always guaranteed. If you don't use guided, then we get into custom abutments. I mean, my rule of thumb is I like custom abutments in the anterior. I like tie bases in the posterior. Mm. You know, there are certain cases in anterior we can use a tie base, but anterior implants, you don't want any tissue recession. You don't want any complications. You know, it is much more challenging. Posterior wise, it's a lot easier to put the implant in, and we get that. But if you want to really hone that cost effectiveness down, guided would solve that. And the difference between a tie base and a custom abutment is about the same price as a guide. So, you know, you would argue that maybe using a guide actually, and we offered a bit of a discount, might be a better long-term solution. Yeah, I'll have a think about that one.
next question I have for you, Ash. Let's circle back to full arch. Mm-hmm. You know, all on four historically has been the powerhouse, rightly or wrongly. We're not getting into philosophies. I do believe it's overused, the FP3 style. But there's a level of complexity that's involved with FP1 as well. So let's just focus on the FP3 at the moment.
Fine. Mm-hmm.
So there's loads of different ways of doing it. There's acrylic wrap, just using denture teeth. There's using milled PMMA, and then there's zirconia, and then we can talk about whirly bridges as well.
Yeah.
From a dentist perspective, and somebody who's done a lot of this, I see a lot of complications with teeth fracturing in the medium term. From your point of view, technically, what is the best way to do it? From my point of view, the best way to do it would actually be a whirly bridge. Because then if any of the teeth fracture, all you have to do is cut that one tooth off, scan it, and make a new crown just for that one tooth.
Yeah.
So for those that don't know, a whirly bridge is effectively your bar has got individual crown preps.
Yeah, it looks like a full mouth of preps, a titanium bar. Yeah, you're literally looting, you know, 12 crowns to it, and then you're putting pink composite on.
Yeah.
Now, I would say no, not the whirly bridge. For me, that we love a whirly bridge because I think it really does it does look fantastic, and you put lovely pink composite on. The problem for me with the whirly bridge is composite. I've never been a massive fan of composite. I think it discolors, it stains. It doesn't matter what you do with composite. I never get more than 5 years of good results with composite. So I want to, if a patient's got a full arch, I'm realistically aiming for 10 to 15 years. That's my target of putting that bridge in and it looking fantastic for a minimum of 10 years. I can't do that with composite. For me, the best restorations that I like, and if it was my mouth and I was doing fix, I would go for what we call it a taco bar. There's various names for it. It's a titanium sleeve, titanium bar. And then we make a zirconia sleeve that we loot onto the bar. You have a titanium, titanium's in contact with the soft tissue, which is really good for the soft tissue. Then we have pink porcelain, which doesn't discolor or stain. And then you have a sleeve that's made of really good translucent, because you don't need the strength, beautiful zirconia. We spend a lot of time in the green states trimming the zirconia, shaping it into nice, beautiful individual teeth effectively. And then we spend a lot of time on the pink ceramic. They look amazing. They fit, you fit and forget them. And touch wood, I've never had a single fracture. They're just incredible. I used to be a big fan of the Whirly Bridges, but after seeing so many of them coming back with the composites just looking so tired, I've gone away from that thought process now. And I think if we have the space and the design, these sort of taco bars that we do are just fantastic. Okay. The problem I have, though, is that when you've got dual full arches, and I don't know the answer to this, so what do you do? Because you can do zirconia on zirconia, okay? And we have done many, many cases like that. But you do get this funny clicking noise, like clack, 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 clack. They clack. Some patients like it, some patients don't. We find it slightly less on the taco bars because I think the titanium is taking a bit of the shock absorbency in a weird way. But it still happens. So then we need a softer alternative. Acrylic wraparounds we still do, but I don't like them posing zirconia because you get tooth fractures. And we're using stock denture teeth of the highest quality. And if the teeth splits down the center, there's nothing I can do as a laboratory. That's a pre-manufactured component. And they do break. There's no two ways about it. They just break. And patients get upset and it's a challenge. Then we could do maybe milled PMMA, which actually I'm quite a big fan of. You mill the PMMA, we put pink acrylic on. They look great. They're much softer, so they do wear. But actually, we can change them over in 24 hours. So providing you've got a provisional, you can put provisional in. 24, 48 hours later, you've got a new lower PMMA bridge, which has got the titanium sleeve in. We are dabbling with composites at the moment. And again, I know I said I'm not a huge fan of composites, but Vita have launched a really interesting multi-layered zirconia, which is designed for digital dentures and potentially full arch restorations. We're testing that at the moment, seeing how we go with that. It mills beautifully. It seems nice. We're hoping it might be a little bit harder and less, shouldn't discolor as much, but I'm not sure. And we've also got a material called graphene, which is like a reinforced PMMA, but we find on certain cases a little bit brittle and it breaks. So it's always the dual arch. It's always a slight, I don't have that perfect solution at the moment. But no. For me, definitely, the zirconia sleeve on a bar is just such a nice restoration. They look stunning. I'm not here to sell the lab, but if you go onto like our Instagram or Facebook, you'll see loads of them on there. And you wouldn't know they're not individual teeth. And that's where it's really interesting for me. It's all full contour zirconia. So we may maybe micro layer the six anteriors, but there's nothing to chip, break or fracture. And I said to you, we've done, I don't know what the stats are now. We broke 100 about 6 months ago. So we're probably around the 150 mark now, I suppose. And they just don't fail. They just fit and forget. And that's what I like about implant dentistry. I don't want to see that full arch ever again.
Yeah. Same. Ash, I think we've covered quite a lot. I don't think I've got any more questions for you at the moment. Is there anything else you think you feel we should cover at this stage?
I have got one thing. Yeah, fine, far away.
A couple of things, conversations that we've had. Firstly, implant crowns should not look like natural teeth because the occlusion on implant crowns is very different to the occlusion on natural teeth. And the other discussion that we've had in quite some depth as well, if you remember, I was really picky about this as well, cleaning and disinfecting prosthetics before they come back to the lab.
Yeah.
So if you just talk us through your process, because the other thing that I say as well is my lab work that I get back, once it's been disinfected, do not put it back on the model. Because as clean as the models look, they are still dirty. They are working models.
And it's also one of the problems with gypsum. Gypsum naturally is a natural product, and you cannot eliminate bacteria from gypsum. Printed models, actually, you can, but you can't on gypsum. So screwing it back into gypsum model is never a good thing. No. I mean, from you, Pavi, it's been great working with you because you pushed us a little bit. You know, your attention to detail and your, you know, if it's not right, you don't hold back and you tell me. And that's been very good for my team because when it's wrong, you certainly let me know it's wrong and we fix it. But for me, I mean, we always ultrasonic all of our crowns. We clean them. We put them through a cleaning solution. Again, with one of the challenges is that a lot of labs, for example, and I'll be guilty, we used to do this, you steam clean. Steam clean is great for one thing, but the trouble is that cements don't like going above 60 degrees. So as soon as you start to steam clean, if you over steam clean and you've got a tie base or you've got a zirconia crown or a custom abutment looted together, you're breaking down that cement bond, and that's not good. So now we tend to ultrasonic and we disinfect and then we put it into the pot. We will steam clean the screws and that kind of aspect. And that's a better way of doing it. We also try to ensure that we polish as much zirconia as possible. Any zirconia that's in contact with soft tissue should be polished. Pontic should be polished. We know zirconia is really good for soft tissue. So making sure we have that kind of little bit that's in contact with soft tissue is beautifully polished also is quite important. But occlusion is a challenge for us. Again, my time spent with Mike was priceless. The whole thing of sort of, you know, teeth impacting the periodontal ligament and implants not is a challenge for us. You know, we do get crowns that come back and say it's fracturing out of contact. No, it's supposed to be out of contact. That implant crown, if you're tapping with your, you know, your occlusal paper, should not be in contact. If the patient really squeezes as hard as they possibly can, you should see a tiny dot on it. And that's it. But then that becomes challenges, is that we want to make sure we have a relatively flat occlusion. We don't want it to be interfering with any excursions. And we're constantly in a battle. You know, the lab that we are, we get a lot of very, very complicated cases where the occlusion is car crash. And then we have to really very carefully think about the occlusion, how we design it. I'd love to say we get it right all the time. We don't. I would also say a lot of implant stuff that I don't think we also do enough splints. A lot of complex implant work, I would far rather the patient wore an occlusal splint. I'd think you'd see vastly less fractures and failures. The evidence shows you get vastly less fractures or failures if the patient is wearing a splint at nighttime. But for the 95% of full arches we do, we don't. We're actually just about to start offering a promotion sort of thing where it's a half price splint when you have a full arch to hopefully actively encourage this. But again, a lot of the occlusal issues, I think, would be assisted if we were to think more long-term with our patients. But it is certainly a challenge. And patients want perfect aesthetics. And you've got these lovely spiky occlusal teeth, and then you put an implant in the middle and it's flat. Patients don't like it. So then we're trying to find that compromise. And that's the fun and games of always being a lab. Yeah,
it's that blend. Times. And, you know, I always say to my patients, I say, look, it's not going to look like a natural tooth. I said, if it looks completely like a natural tooth, I said, I've not done my job correctly. And you remember how you said you've had dentists turn around and say to you, why is this out of occlusion? Mm. We've had conversations the opposite, where I say, Ash, why is this in occlusion?
In occlusion. And that's a big problem. It's in occlusion. It's
marginally out of occlusion. Yeah. You know, I just express it to the patients that, you know, the biomechanics on implants is different to the biomechanics on teeth. That when you're speaking and talking to people, you're not really going to notice anything. But if you get really up close with a picky eye, then you will be able to see that there's an ever so slight difference. I said, but nobody's going to be looking at you that closely. And I think, again, this is a major issue where, you know, a lot of – and when I covered this topic on the Academy, because obviously I've got a lot of delegates who have – they've done other courses, they've done master's degrees, and they're just like, why weren't we told this before about, you know, if you angulate the implant slightly or move it left, it changes the torque going through the implant abutment interface. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. It should be taught. So if your implant crown looks exactly like the natural teeth and it's in occlusion, you've increased the torque going through the implant abutment interface.
Yep,
so it's really, really important that everything is managed correctly.
Yes.
And it's the same, you know, any cases that you send back for me, you know that you've got a working screw and I have a brand new prosthetic screw.
Yeah.
Because as you're screwing these things on and off, even if it's not fully tight, they are getting stressed.
Yeah, they are.
So if I get a brand new prosthetic screw, the preload is optimal. You know, it's all these little things which add up to success.
They do. I agree.
Yeah. Ash, I think we should call it a day here because we've been going best part of an hour. I don't know how long this attention span has been going. I knew this was going to be a solid one. And to be honest, we could probably fire off still another seven more.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
But I think for the sake of people's attention span.
Yes, I agree. It's a great time being a lab, though. I mean, it really is. I've never enjoyed it as much as I am now. And with the new technologies that we have now, and it's changing so rapidly, it's a really, really cool time. So I'm always happy to talk about it.
So for those listening, if you want to find Ash, just tell them best way to find you, just to look at examples of your work.
Yes, I mean, we're under Burns Dental, BYRNES, Burns Dental. You can find it if you just search that hashtag. We're on LinkedIn, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. And, you know, always happy to hear, to have a chat. Even if you've got a complicated case and you don't want to send it to us, you know, dentistry is something that needs to be done better, in my opinion. And so we're always happy to offer free advice. But yeah, if you just Google me, call the lab, you'll find me relatively easily. And always happy to help and try and make implant dentistry a bit better.
Excellent. Thanks, Ash.
Cool. No worries. Absolute pleasure.
So thank you very much to all you Titani nerds for listening. I've got some exciting news. So the Academy has been put to EduQual and we're trying to get it as a diploma, level 7 diploma. So that's now pending approval. And I can't remember the full title, but it is the Academy of Implant Excellence. Diploma in Comprehensive and Full Arch Implant Rehabilitations, EduQual Level 7, approval pending. that's the current title of it, so I'm excited. I also have the autogenous course that I'm running in September with my good friend Dr. Uz. You need to see this guy's ridge preservation technique with autogenous bone. It is insane. I've told you before, autogenous bone is still the gold standard. It still works best. It doesn't have to be complicated. And Dr. Uz and myself, we will be disclosing all of our tips, tricks, and secrets on this course. So hopefully we'll see some of you there. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today. And yeah, I'm sure we'll be in contact soon doing some more cases. And if you do start to do the discount, if you're doing the guide and the crown as well, I wouldn't mind a little bit of an extra discount for giving you that idea.
Yeah, no, so. No, 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 no. My pleasure.